I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. It was a long night last night as votes from the 2020 election trickled in with no clear victor for the White House. And it could be a few long days, maybe even weeks, until a winner is declared. Neither President Trump nor former Vice President Biden have the 270 Electoral College votes to take them over the top. That's of 10 a.m. November 4th. And it looks like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania could be where this presidential race is won or lost, just like in 2016. Here in Pennsylvania, the 67 counties are still counting votes, including millions of mail-in ballots, some of which are being challenged by the GOP. Now, early this morning, Biden, speaking from Delaware, urged calm and declared it wasn't his place or Trump's place to declare the winner. Quote, it ain't over until every vote is counted. A little later, and speaking from the White House, Trump declared he had won the election and called for all the voting to stop, claiming vote counting was a, quote, major fraud on our nation, and vowed to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. Fact check here, presidents can't stop vote counting, and they can't declare themselves the winner. Well, here to talk about where things stand and what it means, we've got Will Bunch, who joins us. He's national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Will Bunch, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, Marty, thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Also with us is LaFleur Stevens Dugan, and she's an assistant professor of politics at Princeton University, author of Race to the Bottom, How Racial Appeals Work in American Politics. LaFleur Stevens Dugan, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, Marty. Great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And rounding out our trio of guests, we've got Christopher Nicholas, and he's a Republican political consultant based in Harrisburg. And Christopher Nicholas, nice to have you back with us as well.
Hi, Marty. We all survived election day.
We're all tired, and there's much we don't know, but we will talk about it anyway. Let me just make sure our listeners can join us as well. You can join our conversation, and we've got a lot to talk about. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. LaFleur, let me begin with you, but this is a question to the three of you. I'll just put it out there. I think most pundits, most pollsters were telling us that by Wednesday morning, we probably would not know who won the White House. But are you surprised at how close everything is, LaFleur?
I have to say that I'm actually quite surprised, and that's speaking as a survey researcher. For example, I didn't expect that Biden would win Florida, but the polling beforehand actually suggested that it would be a lot closer than it actually turned out to be. So I think this is another election where we're going to have to do some postmortem, you know, autopsies on the polling industry.
And we will do that, I promise you. Let me get you, Christopher Nicholas, to respond. As things stand now, and of course, you know, we don't know who won the White House. There are many undecided races so far. But are you surprised that we are where we're at this moment?
No, I'm not. And I am also a Republican pollster. And I have to say I surveyed in at least a dozen legislative districts in Pennsylvania this year. And Trump was only at his 16 margin or better in one of them. So obviously some things changed since I was in the field anyway, in late September and late October. So I'm not surprised. I think Michigan and Wisconsin are going to, you know, be called for Biden before we get around to finishing our vote. So, but no, with all the new registrants and new machines in most counties, plus the vote-by-mail stuff, I'm not surprised it's taken this long. And I think it's a good day for legislative Republicans in Pennsylvania. It seems like we have increased our margin in the state Senate. We still have too many uncounted votes in Southeast PA to talk about the state House, though.
Well, let me get you in on the conversation. And just because Christopher Nicholas talked about the other two battleground states, how important do you think Pennsylvania will be in deciding who wins the White House?
That's a good question. You know, right now people are looking at the Electoral College map and they're seeing a scenario in which if all of the results as of right of this minute, you know, 10:15 Wednesday morning,
right,
stayed the same, which, may not happen, of course. Biden would just barely have 270 electoral votes. I mean, he would win by one vote without Pennsylvania. So what I'm saying is there is a pathway to victory for Joe Biden that doesn't depend on Pennsylvania. And I do think Pennsylvania looks pretty strong for Biden because of the Philadelphia and Philadelphia area votes that are coming in so late, even though the machine counts right now show Trump with a lead in the state. But I do think Pennsylvania looks very good for Biden. And I also think that Michigan and Wisconsin, where as the other guest said, looks even stronger for Biden right now. And Arizona and Nevada, states where he's leading, but not by a lot. If he wins those four states, then he would become the next president, barring whatever crazy challenges the White House has in mind.
Well, Christopher, let me go back to you just to give you a chance to respond to that. How do you see Pennsylvania?
Well, I think it's going to end up being Biden plus 130,000 votes. When you look at all the places that have votes out, they're all Democratic counties.
Right.
And some of them even have Election Day votes out, but mostly they're the vote-by-mail types. So it's not that our counties are slow. I think they're kind of on schedule. But we are just, pop it in the microwave, have it done in 30 seconds culture. And we all want it done now. And I think it's important to remember that we're on schedule here. These Election Day officials and the volunteers are doing a terrific job. But I think in the end, we're going to have a split result here. We're going to have Republicans still in control of the legislature, Biden winning Pennsylvania. And it looks like the Republican nominee for Auditor General, Tim DeFore, has a fighting chance to win that open seat against Philadelphia's Nina Ahmed.
Oh, that's fascinating. LaFleur, let me get you back in on the conversation with another question about voter turnout. We're looking at almost 100 million people voting by mail. I think for a lot of them, they were worried about the pandemic and just, crowds at polling places. We don't have the numbers yet for in-person voting, but there was a lot of engagement. How did you see voter engagement from your perspective?
Well, it seems that the Biden campaign in particular started using more sort of unconventional methods to, boost turnout, right? And this is an election, everyone's saying this, that's like none other before, right? Because we're doing this in the midst of a pandemic. And the fact that turnout was so great talks about maybe, some rethinking of how we do our voting, right? Hmm. So the idea that people were able to vote sort of conveniently, early, by mail. I think this suggests that you can actually get people a bit more engaged, whereas if, voting is limited to, say, Election Day, for example, people are battling things like childcare, elder care, getting off from work. And so I think this was actually a way to, make the process actually more democratic.
Well, let me ask you. Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, we're on the radio. Small D, Democratic. Well, yeah. Will, let me go to you and let's talk about the rallies. President Trump, I read some, both Biden and Trump had more than 50 campaign appearances in Pennsylvania. I think that was since 2019, 10 appearances since just this past Saturday. Comparing how Trump held rallies and how Biden held rallies, obviously very different, one abiding by the CDC guidelines, one not. But do you think having big crowded rallies is a more effective way of rallying your support?
Yes and no. I mean, what I think about that is kind of complicated in that I think having these rallies did help Trump because there was clearly a lot of enthusiasm in Trump country for reelecting their president. And, you saw long lines yesterday in Lancaster County or these other rural parts of Pennsylvania where Trump is the dominant candidate. And he did what he had to do, I think, in getting his base of people worked up. The thing is that Joe Biden's base really has just such a different mindset. Joe Biden did very well against in suburban households, and particularly with suburban women, people who are the most concerned about the coronavirus. And these are voters who saw the fact that he wasn't having these super spreader type rallies, and they responded to that positively. And so you saw big turnouts. I mean, if Joe Biden does win this election and becomes the next president, and it looks slightly more likely that's going to happen as of this moment, it's because suburban voters and suburban women in Michigan and Pennsylvania and outside of Milwaukee, responded positively to the way he ran his campaign. So, I think each candidate did what they had to do to energize the base, and the result of that is this record turnout. I mean, in terms of the percentage of registered voters, this appears to be the highest turnout presidential election since 1900. I mean, that's incredible, and I think it shows that both sides really just energized their supporters.
How did you see the rally, Christopher Nicholas? How did you see the Trump rallies? And certainly where I live, lots of Trump signs, big Trump banners, big trucks with big Trump signs. I mean, it was big and bold.
The rallies were definitely therapy for Trump, talk therapy for him. They were also a great way for the Republicans to see that, hey, there's others like me here, fill in the blank wherever we were. And it was good for juicing turnout because those people went home from the rallies more energized than they were even before. So that helped with the turnout. Someone said on Twitter back in 2018, I wish I could remember it, that our elections now are less about elections and more about a census of just how many R's and D's there are in each specific, a locality. So I just want to give a shout out to the PAGOP and the Trump team in Pennsylvania. I don't think they're going to get over the finish line with their candidate, but they did a tremendous job. And the trends we saw in Pennsylvania the last couple of years continued. The Democrats doing better in better educated suburban areas and Republicans doing better in more rural and ex-urban areas. As I've said all along, the problem with that is math. More Pennsylvanians live in suburban Pennsylvania than in ex-urban and rural Pennsylvania. So that's a reckoning the Republicans have to figure out.
We're almost up on a break here. I think it's very interesting that you were saying that these rallies were therapy for Trump. What, making him feel better about himself, about the race, all the things that therapists are supposed to do.
Exactly. I mean, the 28 campaign, 2008, McCain and Obama, they mostly held, Obama had rallies, but they mostly did a lot of roundtables where people asked questions and they responded. Nowadays, whether because it's how Trump likes it or how the Democrats were forced to do it because of COVID, it's really just standing up there and talking to people. So the Democrats had honking cars because they did it in a more socially distant way, and Republicans had these huge big-ass rallies that everybody liked. So everybody was happy.
Big-ass rallies, set on Radio Times. That's Christopher Nicholas, also with us, LaFleur Stevens-Dugan, and Will Bunch. We are making sense of the presidential race, some other races as well. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. As we all know, Election Day has come and gone. The future of our country on the ballot. Today we're talking about the results such as they are from the election, and we're talking with Will Bunch, a Philadelphia Inquirer columnist. We're also talking with LaFleur Stevens-Dugan. She's an assistant professor of politics at Princeton University, and Christopher Nicholas. He's a Republican political consultant based in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. LaFleur, I want to go back to you and to you, Will, as well, and probably Christopher, as I'd like to hear from you as well, just to respond to what the president said. I think it was around 2:30 in the morning. First of all, he declared he won the election. He called for all the voting to stop. He called voting basically fraud, something he has done in the last couple of weeks or even months, vowed to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I just, you know, it's pretty extraordinary, LaFleur, to have a president declare themselves the victor before the results are in.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're seeing and what we continue to see is an erosion of our democratic norms. You know, it's quite shocking in some ways, but it's also par for the course for how this president has operated. To call for the voting to stop, the voting had stopped. The counting of the votes should continue as long as people cast their votes by the, you know, deadline. And so to hear him undermine the process, to undermine confidence in our political system, I think this is going to have repercussions that are far beyond this 2020 presidential election, even as we might expect Biden to pull it out. What does that look like for how Biden's able to govern if, you know, a significant fraction or a non-trivial fraction of the population thinks that he, you know, his win was not legitimate? And so it's really problematic. It's really troubling. And I, for one, am concerned.
Are you concerned, Will?
I'm concerned. You know, I mean, Trump was just exhibiting the behavior that he has been telling us and has been signaling us that he was going to exhibit for months. You know, he said beforehand he thought the election was going to be fraudulent, and we kind of knew that he was going to declare victory. The thing is, he can't do that by himself. I mean, I think we all know he can't succeed unless he gets a lot of different courts or state legislatures or groups to somehow back him. I mean, he wants to shut the vote counting down, but as I said, if all the vote counting stopped right now, Biden would have 270 electoral votes, and then what? So, you know, I think the onus isn't on Trump. I think the onus is on us to, you know, keep counting the votes. You know, the Democrats supposedly have a good legal team. They need to fight every challenge, and at least on that front, I think we should be okay. Mm. And you know, it's a shame that we're not surprised by Trump's behavior at this point. But no, I'm not surprised by Trump's behavior.
Christopher Nicholas, is that part of his therapy?
Look, Marty, you never stay in a bar after midnight. You never hold a press conference at 2 a.m. Okay, that's just how you have to run things. So no one should be surprised at how Trump characterized the race last night. It was 99.9% wrong, and luckily all the good election officials in our counties and the counties across the state are going to continue to do their job. I do think there'll be litigation here about the ballots received in the mail today, tomorrow, and Friday, because that was kind of shoehorned in all by itself by our state Supreme Court, which seems to think they can just rewrite election law all by themselves and cut out the legislature and the governor. So I think we're going to see some traction there, but it remains to be seen. At some point, I believe most counties are are segregating them. Will they even be enough, you know, to worry about? Because in the primary, my memory is you did not get a ton of ballots in, because we did this in the primary, too. We didn't get a ton of ballots in Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. We had to wait for them. And the other thing to remember is we have a two-week window for overseas military ballots, which is the norm that hasn't changed in our flurry of changes to our election system here. In 2016, we went to bed, and Trump was up by 77,000 votes here in Pennsylvania. And 2 weeks later, when all the military had come in, et cetera, he won by 44,000. So we've got a short window here and then another longer window. But I think, as a lot of people say, you know, the country argues and the lawyers get rich.
The country argues and, yeah, there's some truth to that. Let me read a couple of comments. One from Jerry. I'm mostly worried that cooler heads will not prevail, and this is going to be a very rough couple of months for everyone. Email from Terry. Republicans are accustomed to majority power with a minority of the popular vote, thanks to gerrymandering. And I don't have the popular vote at my fingertips. My understanding is that Joe Biden is ahead when it comes to the popular vote. So it'll be interesting to see how that ends out or not. Let me get Joseph from Center City, Philadelphia, to join our conversation. And Joseph, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Hello, this is Joseph. I'm calling from Center City, Philadelphia.
Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
Hello. The Democrats put a lot of money into increasing their Senate and House totals nationally, and they both failed, obviously. Do you think this is going to mean new leadership in the Senate and House?
In Washington, D.C., Joseph?
In Washington, D.C., yeah.
Yeah, let me see if Will wants to weigh in on that. Will?
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts about the House and Senate elections. And I mean, I hadn't been thinking in terms of new leadership, but obviously this was a massive fail by the Democratic Party. In fact, it looks like the conventional wisdom in the House was that nationally the Democrats would gain seats, and it looks like they actually lost seats. And when all the dust settles with the Senate, it seems almost certain. You know, you have kind of a funky situation in Georgia where there will be one or maybe even two runoffs in December. So, but realistically, I think Mitch McConnell is going to be the Senate Majority Leader for the next 2 years and beyond. And I mean that should have a lot of repercussions for the Democrats and for everybody, because I think in the end, I think a year or two from now, when we look back at what was really important about last night, we may actually realize that the Republicans retaining control of the Senate meant more for America than whether Biden or Trump became president. I know that sounds kind of weird after we've invested so much in the presidential election, but if Biden holds this lead and if he takes the oath on January 20th, and if he has a Senate that's led by Mitch McConnell, how is he going to get a Supreme Court justice confirmed? You know, he's promised to take action on climate change, which is just going to be so important in the 2020s. And he's going to have a Senate that is in the back pocket of the fossil fuel industry. If the Amy Coney Barrett Supreme Court strikes down the Affordable Care Act, how is he going to replace that with Mitch McConnell running the Senate? So the implications of what looks like a 52, 53 seat, probably, Senate majority for the Republicans are going to be, it's going to be continued gridlock. And, with Americans so angry and so divided right now, how angry are people going to be if Washington can get nothing done the next 2 years?
Chuck Schumer's having a tough morning. Okay.
Yeah.
A very tough morning. And right now, Republicans have gained a few seats in the House, but we got to remember, as those vote-by-mail states out west come in, that's always tough news for Republicans. Now, we've probably lost pretty much all the seats that we could lose out in California and those places, but it's true. I mean, the Republicans picked up seats in South Carolina and Oklahoma that they shouldn't have lost in 2018, but won some surprise seats in Texas and New Mexico. As it stands right now, there's only one incumbent congressman in Pennsylvania who's seriously behind right now, and that's Democratic Connor Lamb out in Allegheny County.
Oh, he's behind. Interesting.
Yeah,
didn't
but
know
there's
that.
There's still a lot of votes to be counted there.
Sure.
So that's,
sure.
No one can put that in their win column. But, I mean, what is the average age of Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, and, Mitch McConnell? That's who's going to be running the country for the next 2 years, it looks like.
Let me just, since I raised the question, and this is according to the Associated Press, it looks like Biden is ahead by about 2.5 million votes, 50.1% versus 48.3%. I'm getting several different messages here. I just want to make sure I'm correct before I say them on the air. Let me just quickly reintroduce everybody. That's Christopher Nicholas. He's a Republican political consultant based in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. LaFleur Stevens Dugan is an assistant professor of politics at Princeton University, author of Race to the Bottom, How Racial Appeals Work in American Politics. I want to ask you about that, LaFleur. And Will Bunch is with us as well. He's a national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And we are talking about the results, such as they are, from last night's election, whether having to do with some local races or other races in other parts of the country, or certainly the presidential race. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. LaFleur, this is sort of a big sort of broad-based question, but how did you see race playing out in the political presidential campaign?
Yeah, I mean, it was at play in so many different ways, from who Joe Biden chose to be his running mate to, you know, the platform that President Trump ran on, which was one of law and order. So first, with respect to Vice President or former Vice President Biden, I mean, his choice for Kamala Harris as his running mate, I think, had a lot to do with race at this point, because given the racial justice protests of 2020, I don't think there was a world in which he could have chosen a white running mate, to be frank. And
as a Democrat, or do you think
as
both
a Democrat?
Okay,
as a Democrat, because I think, you know, we started the Democratic primaries with like the most diverse field of candidates, and at the end of the day, we ended up with a 77-year-old white man, and that's fine. But if he wanted to be able to, I think, energize black voters in key areas like Philadelphia or Milwaukee or Detroit, I don't think, you know, a white candidate, even a white female candidate, would have cut it. And so, you know, we've said, or we've heard many times, you know, things to the idea that black women are the keepers of democracy. And I think he was strategic in choosing someone who could energize the most loyal supporters of the Democratic Party. That being said, race is also at play, even in the choice of Kamala Harris in particular, given her sort of law and order credentials and background as a prosecutor. So even with the Trump campaign's efforts to paint her as, you know, socialist, or that they were going to be, you know, supporting defunding the police, I think the choice of her, given her law and order credentials, was strategic as well. Yeah.
And LaFleur, how much you think Obama was out on the trail? He was really out there talking to Democrats, and particularly Democrats of color, saying it's time, you got to get out and vote. How much do you think a difference did that make? And perhaps you don't know the answer to that, because we're still waiting for all the results to come in.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know the answer, but what I can say is he campaigns like no one else. And I think he was able to, you know, get people excited. And whether that translates into turnout at the polls, you know, it's still, I mean, we know turnout is out, but is up. But, you know, it still remains to be seen. But I think if anyone was going to energize the base, you know, it was Obama.
Well, Will, and also to Christopher, I'm thinking about President Trump's kind of final message. He intimated that he might want to fire Fauci. He continued his name calling and enjoying his rallies, chanting for locking up Hillary or locking up Obama, locking up Biden and Biden's family. I guess on the face of it, it may be in sort of a traditional politics, it seems like a strange way to close out your campaign. But that seems to be something that works with his voters. Do you understand why?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think all of those things, I think, are a part of Trump's primary appeal to his electorate, which is that he's somebody who drives their enemies crazy. And I think their enemies are the people they perceive as the elites, which may not be the same people that you and I perceive as the elites, because I think of like big oil CEOs and stock traders, but they think of Hollywood movie stars and college professors and journalists like you and me are the elites to them, who look down on them. And you know, Trump, like any great demagogue, populist, whatever you want to call him, knows how to tap into those resentments. And I think that's what you saw on the campaign trail. And it works. You know, I mean, when you think about it, I mean, you know, Donald Trump, for all his awfulness, is one of only 44 men, because Grover Cleveland did it twice. So he's one of only 44 men, and they've all been men who've been elected president of the United States. And you have to have something to get over that mountain, you know. And in his case, you know, it's this sense of how to be a good demagogue, basically. And you know, when he got into the final days of the campaign, he went back to what got him there in the first place. Mm. And the thing is, as we've seen, it may not have worked for him, but it came darn close to working. So you know, and I think part of, you know, part of the uncertain future for America is what I just talked about with gridlock in Washington. But also, I think part of the uncertain future for America is dealing with how we got to this place, and, you know, and how there's so much anger and resentment, and how somebody like Donald Trump was able to come along and tap into that. And, you know, we're not going to solve that problem overnight. No.
Well, Christopher, I mean, he's a divider. He is not a uniter.
He is a grievance-a-thon 24/7, and imagine if he had spent more time talking about the economy, both pre-COVID and coming back from COVID, and his many, good foreign policy successes, especially in the Middle East in the weeks leading up to Election Day. But instead, he went around talking about Leslie Stahl.
But people seem to like that. I mean, people, his supporters seem to, they relish that. They revel in that.
Well, you know, the problem is he has never been as popular here in Pennsylvania as he was on election night 2016. And if you look at everything happening in the country now, Biden has flipped Arizona. He's going to flip Michigan and Wisconsin. I think he's going to end up flipping this. So Trump could never figure out a way to get to addition, and no one could ever convince him. There are smart people around him that know this, that campaigns especially are about addition, but not about subtraction. You know what I mean? So, again, that's part of his talk therapy. Why do you say all that stuff out loud that you want to perhaps fire Fauci? Just don't talk about it and then do it.
Well, and we're,
Can I just quickly,
sorry, we're just up on a break, so we have to take it there. No problem. And just, looks like Biden, 238 electoral votes, Trump, 213 electoral votes. And just this in South Florida, the USPS failed to deliver 27% of the mail ballots. We are talking about the election, the results, such as they are. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow. I didn't get much sleep last night, so my voice is kind of failing on me. Election Day, as we all know, has come and gone, and now the real battle begins. We're talking about the latest on the presidential election, including things like turnout, what we know about the results, so what they mean, and what voting has looked like both locally and around the nation. And again, Christopher Nicholas, our guest, he's a Republican political consultant based in Harrisburg. LaFleur Stevens Dugan is an assistant professor of politics at Princeton University, author of Race to the Bottom, How Racial Appeals Work in American Politics, and Will Bunch, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And again, you can join us by sending us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. I've got CNN on here, and it looks like from the Secretary of State in Pennsylvania, more than a million votes still need to be counted, just to put that out there. Will, I know you wanted to say something. Go ahead.
I did really quick, which is just that, you know, I think Christopher brought up a fascinating thing that I think is going to get more attention in the days to come and hasn't been dissected enough, which is in terms about Trump expanding his base and addition and adding to it. He did surprisingly well among Latinx or Hispanic voters. He really overperformed in that area. I think it's the main reason that he won Florida, undelivered mail ballots notwithstanding. But he clearly overperformed with this group. And I think especially with Latino men, he did very well. And so I think one of the great what ifs of this election is going to be what if the Republican Party had made a much stronger appeal to this group of voters, because, much of Trump's rhetoric around immigration was offensive to a lot of people. And certainly young Latinx voters did not vote for Trump, but he did well with older voters. And you wonder if he had actually made a real legitimate appeal to this voting bloc, if he could have won the election, if he could have saved Arizona, for example, and won some of these other states that have, significant Latinx populations.
Well, and LaFleur, we shouldn't be surprised that this is a very diverse voting group of people who vote in very different ways. And I think there has been a danger of sort of looking at Latina or Latino voters and just seeing them as this sort of monolith, frankly, like African-American voters. I'd just be curious about your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. So seeing how Cuban voters voted in Miami-Dade is very different than how, say, Mexican-Americans voted in Arizona. And we're seeing that, bear itself out. And so to treat them as a monolith, they're very diverse. Even with respect to Florida, the polling that I've seen is that Puerto Ricans in Florida voted for Biden overwhelmingly relative to their Cuban American counterparts. And so we can't treat the group as just one monolith. And there's a lot of diversity, different histories within the group, and that bears itself out in how they vote. And actually, something that Will said in terms of the diversity of the Latinx vote, particularly Latino men, also points to, even Trump's efforts to expand his base. I don't know how legitimate or how real they were, but, some of the outreach that he was doing in the latter stages of the campaign to African-American men as well. In 2016, I think he got, according to exit polls, roughly 13% of Black men, which is, pretty surprising, still a minority, but probably better than we would think. And so in terms of Republicans' efforts, if they want to actually, make genuine efforts to expand the base among people of color, it does suggest that there is, a group of people of color who are receptive to some of the messaging, even when that messaging is sometimes anti-immigrant, but is also, I think, one of sort of economics, this idea of, being a businessman, I think appeals to a non-trivial fraction of men of color.
Interesting. AP has just called Arizona for Biden, just to put that out on the table here. Here's a tweet from Roy. Can we put to rest the idea that moderate Democratic leadership in the time of American populism is a good idea? Do progressives always have to support leadership that is willing to go more than halfway on any compromises? Actually, Will, if I can toss that back to you, because you have looked hard at the Democratic Party and progressives or liberals or even, even far left members of the Democratic Party. How do you see the role that they're playing or even how they have shaped the party itself?
Yeah, well, I've been waiting all morning to see the first Bernie would have won tweet, which I haven't seen it yet, but it's coming, because it's interesting. I mean, you have this strange dynamic where I honestly do think that, again, what we were just talking about with the Latinx vote, Bernie Sanders did incredibly well in California and Nevada and some other states with that vote. And you wonder if had he been the nominee, if he would have done better than Biden did with that group. He certainly appeals to a certain kind of union voter who might have been soft on other Democrats. And but the problem we've seen now two election cycles in a row is that a Bernie Sanders or an Elizabeth Warren type candidate can't seem to get the majority of the Democratic vote in the primaries. Right. So you have this situation where I think that the majority of within the Democratic Party is just hotwired to pick moderate candidates, even though probably I honestly think a progressive could expand expand the electorate for the Democrats in a general election, but they can't get to that. They can't get to that place. So yeah, you're going to see a lot of conversation. And you know, I think if the Republican Senate advantage holds, which it seems like it's going to, and if we see no action on climate change the next couple of years, and if we see little progress on the racial reckoning that began this summer after George Floyd's killing, then I think you're going to see a much more active, amped up, radicalized left. You know, I think you could see talk of a Bernie Sanders type, probably not him because he's maybe too old, but a Bernie Sanders type challenge in 2024 to a President Biden or a Kamala Harris. It'll be interesting, but I do think the left tried to go along with Biden and with the Republican and with the Democratic strategy on the Senate, and there probably a lot of people are not happy this morning.
Well, I wonder if for you, Christopher Nicholas, looking at the Republican Party, how much you think has become the party of Trump. And we know a number of very high profile Democrats, a former governor of Pennsylvania, Tom Ridge, you know, speaking out against the president. There were a lot of very high profile Republicans who, you know, put their support behind Joe Biden. Now, maybe a lot of the liberals in the Democratic Party not happy about that. But what do you make of the shape of the GOP?
If the Trump era is really over in the GOP now, we now, you know, head into some soul searching. And whoever the president is, you know, the party of their party becomes of them. So this will now be Joe Biden's Democratic Party. And you'll have a lot of kvetching by people like Will who say, boy, we should have leaned more to the left. And you'll have that kind of natural back and forth about whether you need to moderate or go more to your side. The Republicans will have the same conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of this stuff is just a kabuki dance. It's just different people in the roles. So, you know, campaigns at the end of the day are run for one reason, that's to win. So if the numbers continue to pan out, as at least the four of us believe that Biden's going to pull it out, well, then they will have run the better race because that's what happens in California, right?
Right.
LaFleur, let me get you. I'm getting a little bit of echo here. We're going to try to figure that out. Okay, I think that's a little bit better. Okay, we got a lot of different technologies going here. LaFleur, we haven't really talked about the role of African-American women in the Democratic Party. And I just want to give you, I hate to talk about people as groups that they all, you know, behave and think similarly. But nonetheless, I mean, the Democratic Party without African-American women is just a shadow of itself.
Yeah, I mean, as I said earlier, they are the most loyal voting bloc of the Democratic Party. We used to say, you know, African Americans generally were the backbone of the Democratic Party, but increasingly we see more nods towards Black women specifically. And, you know, when they turn out, and I think, again, this speaks to the point of why it was important to have a Kamala Harris on the ticket to get them excited. And I think thus far, what we're seeing is that it worked, at least in that regard. With respect to this idea that, you know, they could have gone more progressive,
right?
You know, to be frank, you know, speaking sort of personally and not in my, you know, political scientist hat, you know, Biden wasn't necessarily my first candidate or my first choice. But honestly, I think in terms of how we were seeing things bear out, I don't know if any of the other Democratic nominee candidates could have won from the primaries, right? Like, I think there was something about that middle of the road, you know, suburban, you know, white suburban mom that might have been more comfortable with a Biden than they would have been with, you know, even an Elizabeth Warren or definitely a Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. And I guess we won't know.
No, we won't know. But thanks for putting it out there. But let me toss that then to you, Christopher Nicholas, from your perspective, who do you think, and maybe it is Biden, and you know, we don't know the results. I hear you sort of indicating that you think that Biden is going to win the White House and the 270 electoral votes. But from your perspective, was he the strongest candidate looking at that field of Democrats?
Well, look, I'm a Republican, so take my handicapping of the Democratic side a lot of grains of salt. But as I said in my last soundbite, he won the election. So, yes, he was the strongest. And what happened was is the folks in the Democratic Party, they had a vigorous primary, okay? Biden didn't sleepwalk his way to that. Lots of other viable candidates, 6,804 debates those folks had, and he came out victorious. So you can complain all you want about this person should have won or that one, but Biden's the one who won. I mean, you know, Trump, I would complain, you know, in 2016, boy, he has an advantage because there's 16 other candidates. But at the end of the day, he whomped them all in, you know, sweet succession. So he was the strongest candidate then. It's just, that's how campaigns work, right? The person who gets one more vote than the other side, they're the stronger candidate because they won, and that's why we run elections. So this is all happy, you know, day after talk, but, you know, it's Joe Biden's Democratic Party, and it will be if Michigan and Wisconsin hold out. It'll be his for the next 4 years, and Pennsylvania won't even matter.
Interesting.
Because Michigan and Wisconsin are going to probably finish before us.
Let me read a comment from Larry. He says, you're talking as if Biden won, which has given me 2016 flashbacks. Can your guest also comment on what a second Trump term would look like? And LaFleur, let me just take that and slightly shift it. As you look ahead, I mean, some have said the next couple of weeks, depending on if there are lawsuits or challenges or, you know, whatever is going to happen in our cloudy crystal ball here, that we're really in for a rough ride in the next couple of weeks. Do you think that's true?
I reluctantly say yes. I think it's not to be understated the way in which the president, speaking from his bully pulpit, has really sowed seeds of distrust among many Americans in our political system. I mean, granted, some of those seeds of distrust were there already to begin with. You know, these are people who were often disaffected, maybe don't have a reason to really believe in the system. It hasn't worked out for them. But if anything, he's only helped to foster that even more. And so I do have concerns.
Will, we have you back on a phone, I do believe, from your perspective, and we're almost out of time here, looking ahead. I mean, if the goal is to try to figure out how to pull us together as a country, at least to find some kind of common ground, do you think that that is possible?
No. I'm sorry. I hate to be so blunt. But
I kind of thought you'd say that. Yeah,
yeah,
but go ahead.
I want to back in, Will. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. So I mean, just looking at what we know from the last 24 hours, you know, look, I mean, Donald Trump, I think, you know, most of us who live in the reality-based world agree that, you know, he's the most dishonest president we've ever had in terms of the number of lies, that, you know, he's corrupted the government. He's been willing to use the various tools of government, like the Justice Department and whatnot, to advance his own personal ends. You know, he's just been such an abnormal and inappropriate president in so many ways. And yet, you know, by this time tomorrow, he'll have the second most votes of anybody who's ever run for president in the United States. You know, 70, 75 million people, more people will have voted for him than in 2016. So despite, you know, botching the response to the coronavirus pandemic, he's got more people voting for him than he did the last time around. So we, you know, when we talk about the fight for the soul of America, this is what we're talking about, and the fight's not over.
Well, this is us, as they say. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Will Bunch, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Will, nice to have you back on the show.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. LaFleur Stevens-Dugan is assistant professor of politics at Princeton University. She's got a new book, Race to the Bottom, How Racial Appeals Work in American Politics. LaFleur, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
And Christopher Nicholas, thank you for joining us. He's a Republican political consultant based in Harrisburg. Thanks for joining us on Radio Times as well.
thank you. I still need to be in that studio with you sometime.
Well, we've got big curtains. You're not allowed in the building. Actually, no, almost no one is allowed in the building, but maybe one day that will happen. Thanks to all three of our guests, and we appreciate your comments and calls to Radio Times as well. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.